And this is WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, New York. And our guest on the Made of Clay report this morning is Natasha Thompson. And Natasha, it's good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Eric. This is great.
On this show, we get to know people who are in the community in ways that we wouldn't normally get to know them, oftentimes just because we don't have occasions to ask questions about who you are, you know, what do we need to know about you to appreciate who you are as a person. And I'm glad for you being willing to come us on this show and share some of the things you've learned and some of the places and that you've been and some and the person that you are with us. So with that start, so answer the question people grimace at the beginning of this show, because it's oftentimes hard to know, and I'm interpreting this, what kind of labels to apply to ourselves so we can kind of be accessible, because those labels change depending upon our audience. But in this community, we don't necessarily know who our audience is. And it's kind of like, you know, what are the important things that we hold, that we bring forth to others?
Yeah, that is a difficult question. And, you know, the standard response that I give typically when I'm asked is, you know, my name is Natasha Thompson, and I'm the president and CEO of the Food Bank of the Southern Tier, because mostly when people want to talk to me, they want to talk to me, you know, relative to, you know,
your
my
professional
job.
Right.
And so, but there's a lot more. So, so it's kind of exciting and a little scary to be, asked that question. So what I do for work is, I work at the food bank, and that's definitely, shaped my life. I've been working in food banking actually for 16 years, very soon after graduating from college. So it's certainly been my passion, and it's something I really enjoy doing. But, you know, I'm also married. My husband, Keith, is a social studies teacher at Ithaca High School. You know, we have two lovely pets. You know, we have friends in the community. I'm an only child. You know, I'm a
those
daughter.
Those are all important things, and they're relevant to knowing who you are as a person, but not necessarily your professional job or other things.
Exactly.
So my guess is that you've painted a picture, a little bit of a picture now, and we're going to fill that in over the next hour. But you also brought some music, and as all of my guests do, to kind of put some of their words in context and to give us kind of a non-rational approach to who they are. So do you want to say more to the question, or do you want to do a little background on the music?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm very excited to be here, obviously. And I think the musical element is really cool, because music is really important to me. And the first song that I'm going to play is actually, it's a Portuguese song. And it's a song called Barco Negro. It's the Black Boat. And it's sung by Amália Rodrigues, who is sort of the grand dame of Portuguese fado music. And I think that, you know, in order to understand me and who I am, it's important to understand my background. And, you know, I'm Portuguese, you know, first generation born in this country, Portuguese. And that was really such a huge part of my growing up, predominantly Portuguese community. All my friends were Portuguese, you know, I went to a Portuguese church, and it was huge. It was like, you know, like a fish swimming in that water. And you don't really understand how much that affects you until you're out of it. And
you don't know your culture till you leave it.
Exactly. Right. So, and this is just such an amazing song. And I'm going to play it now, I guess.
Sure. And I'm going to bring it up.
Que medo que me achasses feia. Acordei tremendo, deitada na areia, mas logo os teus olhos disseram que não, e o sol penetrou no meu coração. Mas logo os teus olhos disseram que não, e o sol penetrou no meu. Vi depois numa rocha uma cruz, e o teu barco negro dançava na luz. Vi teu braço acenando entre as velas já soltas. Dizem as velhas da praia que
That was Amalia Rodriguez singing Barco Negro. And our guest this morning on the Made of Clay Report is Natasha Thompson. And Natasha, so can you, you know, can you say a bit about how your Portuguese roots shape who you are?
Yeah, so it's interesting. It's interesting to, you know, to hear that song, which, you know, hits me on an emotional level because it really, it captures a lot of the sentiment that's pretty commonplace among Portuguese people. There's this idea of saudade, which is what the fado music is all about. It's sort of like this longing,
right,
and for home, for people who have left. You know, the Portuguese had established, you know, colonies throughout the world, and so that whole theme of longing and people who have gone is a constant. And then, you know, leaving my community and coming to upstate New York to go to school, to college, was such a radical thing for someone of my generation to do. Most of my Portuguese friends stayed in the community because the thought of leaving home was so untenable to them. And I knew that I had to. And
why did you have to?
I don't know. There was just there was a pull. There was a pull to leave. Just to see what else was out there, you know? And so I, you know, when I got accepted to the University of Rochester, I was really excited. I also got accepted to Boston College, and my parents were really kind of banking that I would go to Boston College, but I wanted to, because I'm originally from Rhode Island, big Portuguese community, in the region. And, went to Catholic school all my life, and just, you know, was just immersed in that culture. My grandparents didn't, you know, came to this country, they didn't even have to learn how to speak English because, you know, shopkeepers spoke Portuguese, people at the bank spoke Portuguese. It was just, we were immersed in that. And so to leave that was really shocking to my family. But my mom, you know, kind of encouraged me to do that and to leave and explore and see what else was out there. And And yeah, so I didn't notice how much my Portuguese background really impacted me or made me who I was until I left it. Mm-hmm. And even now, even here in Ithaca, it's still, you know, at times I do still feel that, right, that longing, you know.
Well, when you, I guess, so you left, you went from Rhode Island to Rochester, to mm-hmm. the University of Rochester. Mm-hmm. So what did you notice that was either missing or unfulfilled?
Well, you know, the community that I came from was pretty homogeneous in, mm-hmm. in a sense. You know, like I said, I went to Catholic school, which was attached to a Portuguese church, and most of my friends are Portuguese. Mm-hmm. And so we had this way of just interacting mm-hmm. with one another that was, I don't know, it was a little different. When I found myself in Rochester, I was the only Portuguese person that I knew of.
Right.
And it felt a little uncomfortable at times. Mm-hmm. You know, the way that we would interact, my friends and I, and if you're in a Portuguese community and you're sort of brought in, you know that you've become one of the group if they start to tease you. Right. Like that's a very common way of sort of welcoming new people into the group is sort of that, you know, kind of that bantering back and forth, that like gentle ribbing.
In traditional cultures around the world, that's kind of the sign that you're in.
Right, right. Yeah. If you know they like you if they make fun of you.
Right.
And that wasn't, I didn't find that to be the case.
It's not middle America, middle class
no.
culture. No,
no, not at all. So I had to really, you know, shift how I interacted with people because, you know, depending on who I was around, I mean, something like that could be pretty offensive.
Right.
So it was interesting to sort of have that experience. And it's slight, you know, mm-hmm. it's not very perceptible to, you know, to folks when they first meet me and, you know, mm-hmm. or met me back in the day. I've gotten much better at right. sort of curbing that. But it was like almost going against your natural instinct because you didn't know how people were going to react to that.
Right.
So that's just one small example.
Right. But it speaks to that feeling like when you've stepped out of an environment where you are completely knowledgeable and culturally competent and suddenly you're incompetent and mm-hmm. your whole skin almost becomes hypersensitive. So mm-hmm. That was my experience moving from rural Midwest to Ithaca, mm-hmm. which was an urbane school and I had more in common with the people who cleaned the dormitory rooms than mm-hmm. I did with my peers in mm-hmm. college because I lived a life very similar to theirs, so we didn't really know how to talk.
Yeah,
you just feel out of like a fish out of water. So, what brought you to this area? You know, what you know, you've been with a food bank. I know that job brought mm-hmm. you to this area, but what keeps you here?
Yeah, so I when I moved up to Rochester, it was such a radical departure from mm-hmm. where I was in Rhode Island, and it was the first few years were really challenging. But then once I sort of broke into it, probably around senior year, I actually, you know, really enjoyed it, and liked the community and liked kind of that upstate New York mm-hmm. ethos. Mm-hmm. You know, it was the first time I actually had seen people like these very basic things, like, you know, people who know how to fix their own cars and people have wood burning stoves and people who eat like cheddar cheese with apple pie. I mean, these are all radical things that I had never experienced before. And just, you know, just very friendly, you know, very smart, very sort of like self-reliant. I really enjoyed that.
And how was that different than Rhode Island?
Oh, it's it was different. You know, I think, and this might be the same with any sort of immigrant community. Mm-hmm. But you know, there's this thought that, and my mom had this thought when she was, you know, still in Portugal, that, you know, the folks who had emigrated to the United States, like they would be a lot more open-minded and progressive. Mm-hmm. But what ends up happening is the folks who move to the United States and leave their, you know, native countries mm-hmm. behind oftentimes become more conservative.
Right.
And so that's a little challenging. Whereas the people who stay behind, you know, they progress, you know, that the culture progresses in the native country. And whereas the culture kind of
ossifies.
Yeah. Yeah, because you're holding on to your old traditions.
Well, what you've just described is the work of grief.
Mm-hmm.
And with so many migrating people around the world, we really haven't dealt with the way that you grieve what you've left, even though you may be very happy about what you've come to. Mm-hmm. And in a certain sense, it gets frozen.
Yeah. Yeah. So
and some people can get frozen too, because the move was all they could kind of emotionally muster to make, and then their lives remain framed in that.
Yeah, I mean, and some people dealt with it better than others. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've got friends of mine, you know, and their parents, you know, go back to Portugal quite often. Their grandparents go back. They have houses there. My grandmother left, you know, the Azores in 1962 and mm-hmm. never went back. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Never. She just couldn't bring herself to go back. Right. So, you know, it's that it was just that weight that sort of hung on people. And so I liked being away from that and experiencing new things or new ways of life, I guess.
Or wanting not the, I mean, it's to some extent being in a culture that is grieving and out of touch with where it is, mm-hmm. is like wearing a lead suit. It's just very heavy on you. It can be. I think of Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude and mm-hmm. the weight of some of those figures. Different culture, different time, but yeah.
Yeah, and it was something that I didn't appreciate when I was there. Like, it's interesting that I wanted to play an Amália song, because I remember listening to Portuguese music when I was growing up all mm-hmm. the time, and I hated it, and I hated Portuguese food, and I hated going to Portuguese feasts, and I just wanted my mom to make meatloaf, you know? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. and now that I'm older, I have a tremendous appreciation for that, mm-hmm. those elements of you know, my parents, my family's culture. But at the time, I just wanted to be away from it. It was just, I wanted to be American, you know?
Right, in a way that they couldn't let you.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I liked upstate New York, and I did go back home. I went back to Rhode Island for a few years, just until I figured out what I wanted to do. And my boyfriend at the time, who's now my husband, is originally from upstate New York. And so he
went back with you.
He went back with me, and he was not happy in Rhode Island. And so we were actually planning to move back up to Rochester because we had enjoyed it. And on the way there, we stopped, we made a pit stop in Ithaca in the Finger Lakes region and absolutely fell in love with the area. And we thought that it was a great compromise, because it's got that small town upstate New York feel, but there's a tremendous amount of culture, which is, you know, what I enjoyed most about living outside of Providence and in Rochester mm-hmm. was access to, you know, Thai food and art house movies and, you know, things mm-hmm. that I never experienced when I was a kid. Right. When we went out to eat to a Portuguese restaurant. So this was a good middle ground, and we ended up both finding jobs that we loved and we've stayed.
Right. You used an expression as you were just describing this transition, that you wanted to be American.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what have you discovered about being American?
I don't know that I'm still trying to discover what it means to be
What
American.
Are you discovering about it being American? Because I think, you know, that was a kind of a goal you set for yourself.
Well, I think, you know, when I was a kid, I just wanted to, you know, I used to say, I just want to be normal, you know,
yeah.
I just want to...
Like everybody else, as though there isn't everybody else.
right. And then you found out that, you know, there really is no, you know, standard of normal. Mm-hmm. So I guess we all have different shades of normal. And, you know, my version of being American is, you know, experiencing all of the things that I can as an American, having sort of the freedom to do what I like to do. What I'd like to do as an American, and, you know, all the trappings that come with that, but also, you know, being very respectful of my past and where I came from, because we all came from somewhere.
Right. But some of us have come from pasts that we can kind of stand on and stand in, and almost they're almost a weight that's oppressive. And others of us come from a past where we were constantly on the move, and we don't really have any ground underneath us because we were shifting so much because of family or economic class migrations or physical geographic migrations, where we didn't really get a sense of our history. I have five generations of my ancestors are buried within 6 miles of each other.
Hmm.
So they were there from the 1850s in Northwest Missouri. They came through upstate New York on the way. Part of them did anyway. But you have a kind of the standing in a family that had made a resolute move and stayed with it. And now you're moving beyond the move.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a powerful place to stand. So as you, what I want to do is I want you to think about what song you want to go to next,
mm-hmm.
but I also want you to help to start thinking about what issues do you care about?
Mm-hmm.
What are the kind of things that you mull about now as a human being, as a professional? What are the things that catch your attention? And also maybe some of this music will help us move into that.
Okay. So I will, let's see. I think the next song, sort of in line with your question, is going to be Exodus,
mm-hmm.
which is Bob Marley and the Wailers. It's their live version, and we can talk about it after the
Sure.
After the song.
Sure, sure.
Thank you.
And that was Bob Marley with Exodus on the live version from Babylon by the Bus. And you're listening to the Made of Clay Report on WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. And our guest on this hour is Natasha Thompson. And she's been talking a bit about her own exodus out of Rhode Island and into upstate New York. And we're going to turn this conversation more to the issues that she cares about and why she picked that song and how that song kind of interacts with the issues that she cares about.
So I discovered Bob Marley in college, as I'm sure many of my contemporaries have.
Right? He had died long before you went to college, but you did discover him there. Yes.
I did. Yes, I did discover him there. It impacted me tremendously. It really blew my mind, actually, because his music was so politically aware, and it was this interesting combination of spirituality and politics and sort of, you know, this sort of call for social justice and really challenging people to be aware of what was going on around them, and also challenging people who were, you know, the oppressed almost to kind of reframe their reality and sort of rise up and, you know, challenge what was going on around them. And, you know, in college, I was a religion major. I studied religion. Mm-hmm. And it was something I said I was never going to do after 13 years of
Catholic. Well, you expect
Catholic school.
Right. I was going to say Catholic oppression because I've heard you're talking about it. This is you felt it that way.
I did. And I told myself I would never study religion again because I didn't have to.
Right.
And then I went to college and I was a psych major, and I ended up taking a religion class just because I dropped a class and I needed to fill some time, and I was hooked and I loved it.
Right. And it may just. It sounds like also part of that cultural process of being driven away from where it all made sense to having to make sense of it on your own.
Right.
That sounds like it would be part of the culture shock process.
And it was, it definitely opened my eyes to just how, well, particularly, you know, it opened my eyes to the power of framing the world in sort of this religious context, I guess, and especially as it relates to social justice, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that came out, you know, when I was a senior, I took a liberation theology class, and it was all about that. It was all about, people's movements in Brazil and all over Latin America, about sort of reframing the stories in the Bible as, you know, God's always operating on the side of the oppressed. Mm-hmm. And so, we need to sort of reclaim that narrative and fight for what's right, fight for justice. And as I was taking these classes and learning all these really great things, and I was, you know, discovering Bob Marley, and it all kind of, you know, it all made sense to me at the time. And it still does. I mean, when he talks about, when people, people might not agree with you, but they might not see, you know, or understand your perspective. But if you're right, you know, if you know that you're sort of your intentions are pure and that you're on the side of justice, that, you know, everything's going to be all right. And that's that stayed with me. Mm-hmm, and so some of the issues, you know, when I was a kid, you know, my dad came from poverty. He worked in a factory, and, you know, he did really well for himself and my mom. And and so every year we would go on vacation. That was like his thing. My dad would work so hard all year, and he'd go 2 weeks.
That was luxury for him.
Luxury, right, was to go on a vacation. And we would always go to, we would go to places throughout like the Caribbean, because that was close and not so expensive. And I remember when I was 5, we were on a cruise, and one of the places that we went to was Haiti. Mm-hmm. And I remember we were on the cruise ship, and we were docked. We were sort of hanging out. We weren't docked yet. We were sort of offshore, sort of waiting to be allowed to dock. And I remember all these little like Haitian kids who swam up to the boat, and people on the boat were throwing coins down into the water, and these kids would dive down to fetch the coins. And I remember being really struck by that at 5 years old, and feeling very uncomfortable. So every time we went to Bermuda or the Bahamas or what, I mean, these are beautiful beaches, Jamaica, just really nice, like tropical, like gorgeousness. But inevitably we would always pass by some serious abject poverty. Right. And that I always felt uncomfortable with that. And I've always had this sense that whatever I did in life, I would want to do something to address, you know, these issues. Mm-hmm. You know, and at first I thought I wanted to go do that abroad and you know, be a relief worker or, right. you know, go to Africa, you know, be a missionary. I used to love to read about Mary Noel missionaries who were all around the world doing these really great things. But then I realized that there was poverty right here in the United States, right here in my own backyard. And, you know, started to think about ways that I could help, you know, address that issue. And that sort of led me into food banking. And mm-hmm. that's sort of where I've been. So certainly the idea that some people are blessed with so much and other people have to struggle. Mm-hmm. And especially in a country like the United States, especially given my family background, I mean, for the Portuguese and for a lot of immigrants, you know, America is the promised land. Right. And the fact that there are people in America who, you know, still don't, you know, who work hard, but still don't have the resources to adequately care for themselves and their family is mm-hmm. just, it just doesn't jive with everything that my family believes and mm-hmm. experienced and what I was taught. That's a long-winded explanation.
It's actually not particularly long-winded because it gets at how you became sensitized to others who were not like yourself, but it also kind of also allows us to then both look at the story you were telling and also at the Exodus story, because there are some really interesting things at play in the Exodus story. One of the things that the people were told when in their liberation from slavery in Egypt was that they should ask and take the jewelry from those people who were there when they leave, so that they would have some treasure to go with them. And what happens in the course of the Exodus is that they suddenly melt that jewelry down and make it into an idol, or what is perceived to be an idol, or challenged as an idol, and it becomes their own way of being caught by their expectations, in the same way that their Egyptian oppressors were caught. I have this vision of the children swimming around the base of the boat and going after coins. People throwing coins think that they're doing something either meaningful or diverting, and you know, because it's kind of mixed with both. But people who for that. When that's an appropriate action, you're kind of locked into a system of monetary relationships, thinking that it can make some difference. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's just fun for the kids to go diving. Yeah, I mean, that's the other piece of it. And so one of the things that having my experience of liberation theology came through learning about Camilo Torres, who was a priest who joined the revolutionaries in Colombia in 1966 and was killed, mm-hmm. But also later in college and later in seminary. And the oppression and the need to free it, as you were saying, you know, Bob Marley's music is very sensitive to everybody's participation in their own humiliation, mm-hmm. whether it's the affluent or the poor, and how we have to kind of strip that down. And that's one of the things that impressed me about, you know, about seeing you speak and is that you have that sense, is where none of us are free from it. Injustice is a perpetually ongoing work in progress. How does that work in progress play out? You work with lots of different constituencies. You work with the notable people who have been the objects of injustice, but also some participate in their own injustice, but also some who haven't been but aren't aware of the systems that they participate in that lock themselves up. That may be more of a question that you want to go into here.
That's heavy. That is heavy. And, you know, I'm challenged by, you know, working at the food bank or working in food banking for 16 years. I mean, there's an element. I mean, I'm very aware of the fact that, you know, providing emergency food is definitely a Band-Aid approach. Right. It's certainly not the solution to the problem. But the flip side of that is food can be used as a catalyst. I mean, food is community. Food builds community. Food can be used as a catalyst for building community. And I think it's when we provide those opportunities where folks can really meet one another and learn about each other. I mean, it's part of what we're doing here today, right? Except we're not sharing a meal. But perhaps we could be.
but in a certain sense, telling the stories of our lives make this the meal of spirit, of connection, of whatever that we share.
Right. And so that's really something that I've been thinking, giving a lot of thought to, and I'm in a position where I feel like I can actually you know, lead the food bank in that direction. I mean, food is a tremendous resource, mm-hmm. and how do we go from it being just a transactional experience to more of a transformative experience? And that takes a very different approach. And you know, the food bank doesn't operate in a vacuum. We're part of a larger network mm-hmm. of emergency food providers. So we would really need to, you know, get people on board with this notion and really, you know.
Without even any assumption that you're getting people on board, what is the difference? What would it look like? What would it feel like if food were to be an occasion of more relationship rather than just solving somebody's need?
Well, I think what we would need to do is break down that barrier between the people who are distributing charity and the people who are receiving charity. And how do we involve people at all levels, you know, all socioeconomic backgrounds and experiences in this very, you know, it's almost an intimate experience where, you know, you're providing people with the basic sustenance that they need to survive. And how do you give folks a voice in how that's done? I mean, that's one of the things that I feel like we've been missing for quite some time in our approach to our work. And it's something that we want to try to address is how do you get the perspective of the folks who are coming to you mm-hmm. for assistance mm-hmm. in improving what that system looks like.
Right, right, right. And it's tricky because if you ask for their input, you've already set yourself up as one over them. And you almost have to wait till something emerges and comes from them and you can respond to it and show that you didn't initiate it, mm. but they initiated it. And that's where power changes. Pain changes. Emphasis.
And it looks very different in different communities.
Yeah.
You know, so
yeah.
the food bank serves 6 counties in the Southern Tier.
It's a huge area.
It's huge. And each one of those communities is very different.
You want to rattle off the names of those counties just so people can have a picture?
Sure. So we serve Steuben, Schuyler, Chemung, Tompkins, Tioga, and Broome. It's about 4,000 square miles of mm-hmm. mostly rural territory. And we provide food to a network of about 160 community-based organizations, mostly food pantries. Mm-hmm. But any nonprofit organization that provides food to people in need can receive food from the food bank.
Right. And would it be fair to say that your longing is to transform in as much as is possible the way food is secured by people in this region, knowing that there may always be failures and a role for charity, but you long to get beyond it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm not quite sure what that looks like yet, but it's something.
If you knew what it looks like, we wouldn't want you.
Okay.
Because okay, I mean, and that's an arrogant statement on my part. But the mm-hmm. thing is when we don't know what we're looking for, we may actually find what works. Mm-hmm. And when we think we know what we're looking for, we're kind of dangerous, because we want people and institutions and things to dance to what our measure is. And sometimes we have to. One of the most important things that it was said to me when I was interviewing people in some of the poorest neighborhoods in Detroit was a woman who had done countless things, setting up restaurants and building housing and all sorts of stuff. And she said, what I learned from my pastor that was most important is you don't go out to do justice. You go out to discover what justice is. Mm-hmm. And when you discover what it is, then it's what everybody is willing to own and willing to fight about, because it's not always without conflict. But you don't go out to do justice. You go out to discover justice. And that's a phrase that I've kept with me for years.
I like that.
So you have, you know, you're inviting people in your region, and the communities are very different, as you've mm-hmm. described, and they're going to process this opportunity in completely different ways and may head off in different directions. And as a leader, you're going to need to be kind of comfortable and skillful with that. I wanted you to think about transitioning to the next song, but I want to start going to the questions. You know, what have you learned that has forced you to change some strongly held commitments? How have you changed over time? And how do these changes in you make it possible for you to listen to more of these divergent needs and more of these divergent perspectives on justice?
Wow.
We're going way deep. But is there a song on this list that you'd like to use to kind of segue into that, what you've learned, how you've changed?
Wow. Okay. So, yeah, I think the next song that might have something to do with your question, or will at least allow me some time to consider your question, is the song Show Me, which is by John Legend. And it's interesting because it starts off, it's very, this is one of those songs that really kind of surprised me, because it starts off very much like a love song. Mm-hmm. And then I don't know why. I mean, I had this album for a while and listened to it in the car. And then one day it just struck me like, oh my God, this is a song about God. And, you know, it's got, and, you know, it took me a few listens before I actually got that. And when it hit me, it was really shocking. Like, of course it's about God. It's really obviously about God. And those are the experiences that's really, I don't know, it speaks to some of those aha moments in my life where, right. you know, you're exposed to the same thing over and over again. And then all of a sudden one day you look at it completely different.
Right.
And it
right.
was like, was that there all along? Or right. was there something in me that allowed me to perceive it in this way? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and, right. And I also, so when I was in college, you know, part of what I really enjoyed about my religion major studies was I really loved Islamic mystical poetry, which really framed the idea of God as the beloved. So this song is mm-hmm. sort of in that vein. So.
Yep. Thank you.
Thanks to you for all you've given me. Sometimes the price of what you gave to me, I can't stop questioning. Oh God of love, peace and mercy, why so much suffering? To me, wonder if you listen to me. When people go, why do they go? Why don't you choose me? But someday I know I'm gonna go. I hope you wait.
And that was John Legend and Show Me. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest this morning is Natasha Thompson. And Natasha, you just introduced that song as an aha moment for mm-hmm. you when you were kind of getting to know maybe what God was or wasn't. Mm-hmm. My question leading into that was, how have you changed? What have you come to see differently? What was not as you thought it was, and how have you changed over the years?
I think, when I first started in food banking and, you know, when I first left college and started my career, which happened to be food banking, I had this idea that, if we wanted to change the way things were done, we just went in and we changed them and we made a very compelling argument and people we would just fix it. Right. And, you know, people would have no choice but to agree with our fantastically rational ideas. And that was 100% not the case. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that I constantly, am aware of and respect, and particularly in my position. I mean, you'd think, you know, you get to be the president and the CEO, which is a very impressive sounding title, and then all of a sudden you can make these sweeping changes, and you still can't make these sweeping changes.
And for reasons like, you know, these are budgeted government programs for the most part. They have institutional interests that see charity in one way and not another way, and people who experience dependency in one way and not another way. You got a lot of constraints.
Yeah. Yeah, you do. But I think, you know, what I've grown to appreciate is just is the power of getting people together and having these kinds of conversations where, you know, we talk about what kind of community do we all want to mm-hmm. see, and how does food play a role in that, and what is our role, you know, with respect to the need, and those have been really powerful, and I've met some really amazing people who do this work. I mean, most of the organizations we serve are food pantries. Mm-hmm. The average food pantry volunteer is a 75-year-old female. 86% of the organizations that we serve are entirely run by volunteers. You know, they're operated out of faith-based organizations, like churches. So it's a very it's like a cobbled together system. It's a very it doesn't have a lot of, it's not rich in resources other than the desire of certain people who feel like this is important work. And
it's one of those examples where we see clearly the hypocrisy of our economic system, because the work there has no monetary value because it's not monetized. It's not paid labor, mm-hmm. but it has tremendous economic value, mm-hmm. tremendous economic value. But that is the hypocrisy of our system, because we don't track what has economic value. We only track what has monetary value.
Right, right. Yeah.
What else? What about working with other people? What have been the aha moments where you've had to change the way you approach your work?
There's so many. it's constant. It's a constant thing. I think, you know, a number of years ago, the food bank made a commitment to move all of our food pantries to a client choice model of distribution. Mm-hmm. And client choice, it's radical because it seems so obvious, but the client choice model is where, you know, person comes in to, this is what I want, and they select the items that they can get off the shelves, versus the typical system, and really the system that exists throughout the country. You know, the predominant system is, I'm going to pack this bag of groceries for you and give it to you when you come to the door and send you on your way, and, you know, see you next month, because the idea is, if you're hungry, you'll eat anything. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that just didn't that didn't jive for us at the food bank. And it was something that we were committed to. And we knew that this was the right approach. There are many different ways that people can implement client choice. And we spent a long time having conversations and providing people with the resources to make the changes. But what we found was most compelling was not hearing from us, but hearing from their peers. Particularly if you could find a pantry coordinator who was originally completely against the client choice model, mm-hmm. and then who made the change and had it be a positive experience, those were the most powerful people. Mm-hmm. So, and the most, you know, likely to be able to change people's perceptions, not the food bank. And so I've really taken that to heart and, mm-hmm. And tried as often as I can in these kinds of situations, when you're trying to influence someone or trying to get your idea across, sometimes just because it's coming from me, it's not necessarily going to be immediately adopted. But if it's coming from someone who has credibility in their eyes, a peer, someone who's experienced what they've experienced, then people are more likely to be open to the possibility. So just some of those nuances.
Well, and I see kind of a story in there. People can't learn things from you because you have a position, mm-hmm. and that position means that they just can't hear things. But if I'm a food pantry operator and I believe that I know what's best for you and I'm going to give it to you, and then I have to say, you're going to choose because you know what's best for you, mm-hmm. and I have to trust that. And eventually I see that you know what's best for you, and I can give it up and I can say, I don't need to do that anymore. Mm-hmm. That's not a story you can tell. That's not a story you can tell, but that's a powerful story. I don't know if that's the way it gets played out, but or at least in a rough figures, but that's what I saw in Detroit when they were switching to these client choice models back in the mid-1990s. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, the process has been in place. It's a slow process.
It took us probably fully, I think, 8 or 9 years to transition all of our food pantries to client choice. And right now, you know, we are the only food bank in the nation that has 100% of our agencies you know, practicing client choice. So when we have a new organization come to us wanting to start a food pantry, we don't even give them the old model. We say, right, this is how you start a food pantry, mm-hmm. and you could do it, you know, a bunch of different ways. I mean, client choice pantries look different anywhere you go, but the fundamental core is the same, where mm-hmm. you give people the opportunity to select the food that they need, period. I mean, right, that we believe fundamentally that's true, but it's how it gets played out is different from place to place.
And research in Atlanta shows that people on welfare, if they were given all of their benefits as a lump sum and money that they could use for whatever it is they need, they would make the choices which would get them individually the best benefit in the long run, and then they would need it less for less length of time. That's what people making choices with their peers and figuring out what's the best place to get healthcare, what's the best place to get food, what's the best way to do all of this. But we don't believe poor people can do that on their own in general, and it's condescending, but that's where we are.
It is. And people make they make very rational choices depending on where you stand in the continuum. The choices you make are usually very rational, and we don't see that.
We have to adopt their point of view in order to see that. And if we're not willing to do it, then we aren't going to get there. What do you do? What do you do to keep yourself optimistic, to kind of deal with these daily challenges where you can't do the justice work, you're doing Band-Aids? Or what do you do with yourself when life doesn't quite roll the way you would like it to roll? What do you do to sustain, to support yourself, to recenter yourself? What are the practices that keep you somewhat optimistic and working?
So I took the MBTI of not too long ago, and which is the Myers-Briggs personality type, where you can talk about where you fall in the continuum, introvert, extrovert. I always thought I was an extrovert, but I'm actually right on the cusp. I'm just slightly an extrovert, which means that, you know,
you can go either way.
I can go either way. And, you know, we had an event at the food bank on Thursday evening, and there was a lot of, you know, networking with folks and chit-chatting with people, and I was absolutely exhausted at the end of it. I just needed to, you know, take some time for myself, chill out. I love bubble baths. I love cooking delicious food. My husband and I really enjoy traveling. That's something that, you know, I did learn from my dad, but our choice of venue is different. We don't go to the Caribbean. We go other places. cooking good meals, spending time just preparing something with love is really, I mean, you know, one of the other benefits of being Portuguese is like very strong focus on food. Food is, you know, it's primary. You know, I go visit my mom every Thanksgiving and we'll be eating breakfast and we'll be planning what we're going to have for lunch. And then when we're eating lunch, we'll be planning what we're going to have for dinner. It's constant. And so, so I love that, that gives me, that
and you make it together.
Yeah. My husband and I always make food together, which is definitely a departure from the traditional, Portuguese, model where, you know, dad sits in front of the TV and mom cooks, and brings it out to him. So, so this is much more egalitarian and much more enjoyable. It is, it's like, I don't know, that's our hobby. If I could say, that food is my hobby and my passion.
Food is your play.
And it is, so, and then, you know, I do try to make some time for exercise. I do enjoy running. So all those things, I'm thinking I'm at a point in my life where I might want to try some meditation. I think that would be helpful, because I do need to take the time to kind of turn my mind off a little bit and sort of come to a peaceful place.
Right. And that is a skill that can be learned. It's, you know, it depends on what you're up against, how you learn it. But yeah. So neat. And you brought one last song here.
I did.
The Bones of You.
Yes. So the other thing that I do to kind of, you know, tune out, I've always been a driver. I drive. I spend a lot of time in my car. I live in Ithaca. I work in Elmira at the food bank. Spend a lot of time in my car. And I listen to a lot of music in my car and sort of take that as an opportunity to, you know, either prepare for the day or just kind of unwind from the day. And this is one of my favorite bands. It just talks about how a song can remind you of, you know, take you back to a place that, that has some emotional resonance. So, so here we go.
So I'm there, charging around with a juggernaut brow. Overdrive speeches and deadlines to make, cramming commitments like cats in a sack. Telephone burner, a purposeful gate. When out of the doorway, the tentacles stretch of a song that I know, and the world moves in slow-mo straight to my head like the first cigarette of the day. But image on image, like beads on a rosary, pull through my head as the music takes hold and the sickener hits. I can work till I break, but I love the bones of you that I will never escape. And it's you, and it's me.
Was The Bones of You, Elbow. And our guest this morning and this hour of the Made of Clay Report has been Natasha Thompson. Natasha, it's been really good to get to know you.
Thanks, Eric. It was a pleasure being here.
And I look forward to hearing about your work for justice and for the sensitization to all of us on whatever side of an issue we're on to the way we both participate and can bring in justice. Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.